The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Hello, and welcome to the American College of Osteopathic Internists Annual Convention and Scientific Sessions. This year's meeting was held in conjunction with the Annual Clinical Assembly of the American College of Osteopathic Surgeons. The meeting was held October 11th through 15th, 2017, and featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of interest to the practicing physician. The meeting was held at the Gaylord National Resort and Convention Center in National Harbor, Maryland. The program chair is Dr. Annette Karen, and the theme for this year's presentations is Goldilocks Medicine, Not Too Little, Not Too Much. The ACOI, ACOS keynote presentation, The Journey of Exploration, Where Medicine Meets Mars, is presented by Dr. J.D. Polk.
Thanks for inviting me. Let's go ahead and get started. Let's see if I got my slides going here. I'm going to talk about the journey of exploration. Most of you obviously know NASA does exploration. I would assume most of you know that the Earth is not flat, although I keep having to argue that about every week with somebody. But there's a lot that we are doing in exploration that actually comes down into medicine. And a lot of the things that we invent at NASA or the things that we work on for exploration missions that eventually trickle down into your practice that you may have no idea came from spaceflight. This is actually our biggest and busiest time at NASA. The president just announced we are going to go back to the moon. I'm not really sure what that means yet, if we're going back as in around it or back as in boots on the moon, but we'll find out. Obviously, this is back in 1969 for the missions, for the moon missions. We learned a lot back then. Most of you just now are hearing about cars that have different hydrogen fuel cells and things that make them run. The hydrogen fuel cell was back in the Apollo era. That's what actually made the lunar module work and power the lunar module. So, that is not a new thing that just came about from Ford or GM, et cetera. That's back from the 1960s, and it's just now creeping into our vehicles today. This is where we're headed. Even if we go to the moon is going to be a test bed mostly for when we get to the Mars missions. And then that's our journey to Mars. This is the busiest time that we've ever had at NASA, even busier than back in the Apollo program. This is Jeff Bezos from Amazon. This is his rocket. If you want to pay a certain amount of money and be a tourist and go to suborbital flight, see the curvature of the Earth, you can get on Jeff Bezos's rocket. He's actually going to be launching next year, and we've been working with them, obviously. Elon Musk, I think, is almost a household name now. Elon Musk, people think that we compete with SpaceX at NASA. Actually, we fund SpaceX, and they are building a capsule for us to take our astronauts to the International Space Station. This is Boeing's ST-100 capsule. Again, we are funding Boeing as another commercial partner, and that capsule will take our astronauts to the space station as well. This is Sierra Nevada. This is like a little miniature shuttle that will take cargo to the International Space Station. Won't take crew, but eventually may take crew or end up being a rescue vehicle if we need it for the International Space Station. So you can see there's a whole bunch of commercial vendors that are going to be going to the International Space Station. And we're going to turn a lot of that to and from to the space station over to the commercial folks so we can concentrate on the larger exploration missions. This is Bigelow Aerospace. We have one of these modules on the International Space Station right now. This is an inflatable module not like a balloon, if you will, but if Gore-Tex inflatable. I mean, it's a huge, robust capsule. And Bigelow has talked about even having a hotel. So if you want the Marriott International Space Station, you might be able to make your reservation here before too long. But this is what we've been working on, which is the SLS, Space Launch System, and Orion. Orion is our capsule. We've done the drop test. We're working on the heat shield right now. That rocket in the lower right is the rocket that will eventually take our astronauts to the moon and Mars. And so these are the different vehicles that, and the different tests that we've done. On the far left is just the emergency escape launch system that we have on top of the capsule that we've already tested. We already flew one launch to test the reentry module and the rocket boosters, which was in December of 2014. EM-1, which is a larger vehicle, which will be an unmanned mission, is coming up in a year and a half. Then we have another launch with the boosters from the capsule. And then the big one is where we have the first crewed mission, which is EM-2. And that vehicle is larger than the Saturn V and more powerful than the Saturn V. So if you can imagine that rumbling in South Florida, it'll be coming up fairly soon. The next phase is Deep Space Gateway, which is kind of like a small miniature space station, and then Deep Space Transport, which is the rockets attaching to the gateway to take us then to Mars in the vehicle that the astronauts would be in for about 6 months. And so I'm sure you're thinking, all right, Dr. Polk, that's all really interesting, but what's that have to do with medicine? Well, there's a lot of experiments that we do on the International Space Station. This is the space station which has been operating for 16 years. It operates at 250 nautical miles, 17,500 miles per hour, 26 countries, and is still going. We'll probably be going out to 2024 at least, and the commercial vendors, pharmaceutical companies, and others are asking us to extend that, and you'll see why when I go through here. But this, if you had to look at it, you may not know, this is probably the greatest invention in end-stage heart failure. What? This is a space shuttle main engine. What does that have to do with end-stage heart failure? We see when a shuttle lifts off, it has a great deal of thrust, and so everything wants to slide back, right, when it's going up. But you had to drive the fuel up into the pump, and so we had to figure out a particular way to push that fuel up into the pump. And so we invented multiple different turbines and new technology in order to get that fuel up into the pump and allow a smooth flow of fuel into the space shuttle main engine. Dr. DeBakey had a problem with the left ventricular assist device that he was inventing. The propeller was macerating red blood cells. The flow was not very good. It was turbulent flow. There were clots in the aorta. Things were not going well. Dr. DeBakey said, well, who else makes turbines and small propellers and things to push flow up? And he was reading an article about the space shuttle main engines. So Dr. DeBakey made a trip to NASA, and he worked with the NASA engineers, and that same turbine, which is about 7 feet long from the space shuttle main engine, the same technology, the same laminar flow, the same columnar flow is in that small little device that he's holding. We made an impeller, which essentially circulates the fluid and allows it to distribute in a column, so it pushes up like a column or a pillar, and it doesn't cause clots, and it doesn't macerate the red blood cells. That technology is in your left ventricular assist device right now. Does anybody know what this is? Anybody from Canada? This is the Canada Arm 2. You got to remember, the space station's moving at 17,500 miles per hour. I've got an astronaut on the end of this small, robust arm on the end of this end effector, a small end effector, and I'm moving him from bolt to bolt outside a space station, moving at 17,500 miles an hour. The software program to move that arm has to be extremely precise, otherwise astronaut goes smashing into the International Space Station or flinging off into space, that's a bad thing by the way, or having other problems. The same software is in neuro arm that allows for robotic neurosurgery. The same exact software, modified obviously, for robotics, for robotic neurosurgery. Most of you have this NASA technology in your office, you just don't know it. This is the infrared thermal spectrometry that we invented. It's now in the Spitzer Space Telescope. It allows us to tell how hot a planet is, how warm a sun is, identify whether a planet is in the habitable zone or what we call the mesosphere, or for you Star Trek fans, class M. We throw a little sugar at Star Trek on occasion. That's why we called it mesosphere at NASA, so all the people would know that it was class M. It's how you tell what the temperature is on the tympanic membrane, the same technology then used from NASA into your office. This is one that's coming, just to give you an idea. This is one of the astronauts from ESA showing a device that measures nitric acid. before the bronchioles spasm, before the mast cells occur and inflame the bronchioles in asthma or in COPD, the cells release nitric acid. If you can measure that ahead of time and then treat them while they are still secreting nitric acid, before the mast cells, before the histamine, before the bronchospasm, you can abort an asthma attack. You can abort bronchoconstriction and COPD. This is that same device being worked on the International Space Station. That's Tim Peake. He's the ESA astronaut from the UK. You'll eventually see that coming to your pediatric patients near you, and you'll be able to treat little Timmy here before he gets into bronchoconstriction and before he gets into bronchospasm. So his mom will be able to identify if his nitric acid goes up, and then they will either augment with an albuterol or steroid or magnesium and abort before he even has any evidence of an asthma attack. Half of you are wearing these, which I imagine half of you have scratch coat on your glasses. You can thank this. With the space shuttle windows, when we invented it in the late 70s, micrometeoroids, which are small little asteroids and small little pieces of rock or sand that go around the Earth, they were smacking into the windows, and we kind of wanted the astronauts to be able to see when they land, and after you're up there for 14 days, the windows get a little marred, so we invented this stuff called scratch coat, and I test it almost every day because I probably smack my glasses on something. But if you're wearing scratch coat on your glasses, it came from this program. One thing that you're going to see with ultrasound, most of us think of ultrasound as a diagnostic modality, especially for kidney stones, for example. We'll get an ultrasound, see if the kidney stones are there. In the not too distant future, and I do mean not too distant, you will say, let's get an ultrasound to diagnose and to treat the kidney stones. Because we are incorporating high intensity ultrasound into the diagnostic ultrasound so that not only can you see the stone, but then you can vibrate it and break it up or move it out of the calyce or move it past the UVJ. This is that ultrasound on orbit. The astronauts did multiple different studies already showing that they could move the stone. This is what the stone looks like when it's in the calyce, and we have already been able to identify that we can move it, and the vibration and the high intensity from the focused ultrasound can break that up. Now, it doesn't stop there. High-intensity focused ultrasound, when you look at it, if you look at the top left, you see that the ultrasound beam, once it gets narrowed and focused, that's when it starts to get columnar and where the heat spikes. You can see on the far right that little red band down below. That's where you start to get heat in the tissues. That means that you're not heating the skin, you're not heating the fat, you're not heating the muscle, but wherever that beam intensity focuses is what you're heating. Now you take two of those modules and you combine them together to where the points are at the same point. You have two different ultrasound crystals that are pointing at the same area, and I can get really high focused heat. So what are we doing with that? Look at the liver in the upper right, and then our pig studies down in the lower right. We can cauterize a liver without opening the skin. You got a trauma patient who has a liver laceration. Most of you have ever operated know how horrible it is when you get into the liver. It doesn't like to hold sutures very well. Imagine being able to cauterize it without opening the skin. Already proven in the lab, already done on pig studies, working on that now. Why would I work on that? Well, I don't want the Navy fighter pilot, if we're on Mars, opening up your belly. But I might be able to train the Navy fighter pilot to focus the ultrasound on your liver laceration and zap it a couple times and stop you from bleeding if you roll the rover down the hill. So that's the technology that we're working on now. NSBRI, that's the lower left, the National Space Biomedical Research Institute, now the Translational Research Institute, did a lot of these studies in the pig. And we will test this, obviously, clinically out on patients and on the battlefield, obviously, before we take it to exploration and the moon and Mars. But a lot of folks, when this eventually comes down the road, will not know that that came from NASA technology. These are astronauts on the International Space Station working on software for eye tracking. Now, we worked on it because when you get to space and you're no longer walking and you no longer use your semicircular canals, you get saccades. instead of smooth pursuit of your eyes going back and forth, you get saccades when you look back and forth. Well, if I'm going to land on Mars and I'm having you look at this dial and look at this dial, and I assumed you were going to smoothly pursuit there, but now you're jumping around, I had to know how the eye was going to move, how far it would move with each saccade, so that we could design the vehicle so that the astronauts would be able to see the panels when they're landing on Mars. Same software is actually used now by eye surgeons, so that when they are doing surgery and you move your eye, they don't zap the wrong part, because you don't hold perfectly still. Most folks don't know that that came from NASA technology as well. This one's going to be a big one, especially in internal medicine. This is one of our racks that we use for diffusion technology to reclaim water, to reclaim saline, to reclaim moisture. So we can take the moisture out of the air, turn it back into drinking water. We can take sweat, turn it back into drinking water. We can take urine, turn it back into drinking water on the International Space Station. So the astronauts are drinking sweat and urine. How many people want to be an astronaut? Yeah. Some of the technology that we're doing right now is using different membranes and nanotubes to do diffusion and to do osmosis and to be able to recycle those fluids, which means that instead of this massive rack, now it'll be bags and nanotubes that'll be much smaller, about the size of a briefcase by the time we're done. Imagine hemodialysis now with new osmosis and diffusion technologies and new filtration technologies that have been miniaturized. What if your patient can do their hemodialysis at home a decade from now? It's probably on the horizon. We're working with different materials in material science. This is working on what's called transparent enamels and transparent aluminum and several other different materials, making them stronger but also transparent. If you have a daughter who has braces with transparent enamel, she is wearing the space program on her teeth. Most of you know that because you probably paid what amounts to the space program for those braces. The Zika virus. Zika virus, creeping up last year, we had to figure out how could we track the Zika virus and where could we figure out from a risk stratification where we needed to put the most resources. Well, we have a lot of satellites in orbit. If you can see the bottom right, we can measure how much moisture there is from rainfall, but we can also measure the moisture in soil from orbit, essentially, from satellites. And so we were able to tell where the best vectors and where the best conditions were for Zika to thrive, which then allowed them to then target and figure out that Miami was going to be the hardest hit, and not only that, but we could identify which suburbs of Miami that the public health folks needed to go target. So if you've only got limited resources and you can't go to everywhere in the United States, but you had to figure out where to concentrate your public health resources for these mosquitoes, most people have no idea that it was NASA technology and targeting that allowed that to occur. This is Robonaut and Robonaut 2. That's an astronaut on the right, Robonaut on the left. This is a collaboration between us and GM. Robonaut is supposed to be able to do, work on the International Space Station and eventually on to Mars, but we needed Robonaut to work and function with the same tools as the astronaut, quite frankly, for financial reasons. You didn't want to invent a tool that the astronaut could use with their hands and then have to invent a totally different tool for the robot, because we only have so much budget money. So we needed to make the hands of the robot as intricate and as close to the human hand as possible, and be able to tell how much pressure it was gripping with, and be able to actually turn a bolt or a nut with its finger and thumb, just like an astronaut. So we were able to do that. This is Robonaut holding multiple different tools, including the drill wrench. And where does that apply? Well, when you and I grew up, prosthetics were a hook. Now the prosthetics, and especially with the NASA technology, looking at the fidelity and the sensors and the fingertips, a prosthetic can actually allow someone to hold an apple, feed themselves, actually write their name. Now, it gets even more interesting than that. So we use you know, the bicep, tricep, and other muscle activations to be able to do certain muscles and certain motions with the arm, wrist, or with the fingers. But let's say you want to change that. Let's say, you know what, Dr. Polk, I want to move from gross motor with the hand and torquing something and lifting weights to something fine now. Well, there's an app for that. You can actually change it with an app on your iPhone and change the function of your prosthetic to fine motor or gross motor, or to flip around your wrist or what have you. And so imagine now patients with prosthetics that are able to control their prosthetics, change their prosthetics with the touch of an app, and be able to do fine motor skills and gross motor skills. SILS, this is single incision laparoscopic surgery. Because of all the robotics that we work on and the small instruments that we work on, many of those are now bleeding into what's called SILS therapy. It used to be, you know, back when I first started, you looked for the big scar for the gallbladder surgery. Then before I finished residency, it was the three puncture wounds. Now, you know, a resident comes in and tells you Mrs. Johnson had her gallbladder out, and you go in and there's no scar, there's no puncture, there's nothing in the right upper quadrant, and you think the resident got it wrong, and the resident was actually right, because now they took it out through the umbilicus through a single site and a single incision laparoscopic surgery with the robotics, and a lot of that with the tools and instruments coming through space technology. This is Valkyrie. This is our other robot. Valkyrie is a little bit different than Robonaut. Robonaut we can put on the end of the end effector for the Canada arm and move around the space station. This one walks and talks. This is probably the closest thing to Star Wars that you're ever going to see. This robot has stereoscopic vision and walks and talks. Now granted, he's got a little bit of a wide base gait still. He looks like he needs a little Parkinsonian treatment, but he's getting there. And so why would we worry about this? Well, this, you know, this could help out the astronauts on exploration, et cetera, but what would it be used for on the ground? Well, imagine, do I have to send the firefighter into the burning building, or can I send Valkyrie? If we have a radiation incident at a radiation plant like the one in Japan, do I send in five workers who are going to die from cancer from the radiation, or do I send Valkyrie? It changes the dynamic on risk for human beings and things that we're asking human beings to do. That brings us to the exoskeleton, which NASA has also invented. This is an exoskeleton. The astronauts, when they travel to Mars, it's a 6-month journey, and they have a little bit of bone loss and muscle loss, even though we have exercise equipment on board. It takes them a few weeks to build back up when they get onto the Mars surface. They'll still be ambulatory, et cetera, but they won't be able to do a lot of lifting and a lot of heavy exercise. And so they may wear something like this that will aid them to do that. And this has already been invented, and it increases the muscle strength through the legs and the stability through the legs. It can also be used to move the legs. And so we've been working with several universities on taking that technology and having paraplegics ambulate, and it works. 3D printing is another thing that we are very big into at NASA. We have a 3D printer on orbit, and we are working with multiple universities on 3D printing. Now, take that prosthetic arm, and let's say I take a laser scan of your current arm, and then I flip it, and then I 3D print what looks like skin under that prosthetic that you have on the left arm. I can make an exact duplicate of your other arm and match the skin tone and the whole works. So prosthetics will be hard to identify before too long. In the lower right is some really interesting research with Wake Forest University. Most of you know how painful a skin graft can be, especially for a burn patient where they have to take skin from a donor site. What if I take skin cells and I culture them, and then I use them as substrate in the 3D printer, and I actually print the cells onto the tissue and no longer have to harvest them and do a skin graft? They've actually done printing of skin directly onto a burn limb at Wake Forest. That's a huge change in the dynamic of medicine. But wait, it doesn't stop there. You know, most of us think of 3D printers printing with plastics and don't realize that we can actually print with cells and tissue. So now if I take an ear, if someone loses an ear due to cancer or due to some other reason, Can I print cartilage? Yes, I can bioprint cartilage and then bioprint skin over top of it. Can I print, if somebody loses their nose or something due to cancer or basal cell or trauma? Yes, I can probably take a 3D print scan of the photos of what they looked like before, and we can 3D print cartilage and tissue. Already working in the lab, coming down probably within the next decade. It takes about 7 to 12 years before something that we work on at NASA actually comes into the commercial sector and you see it. Because, you know, we don't start a company and sell those things at NASA. We do it for exploration. The upper right is a kidney. Granted, it's a very small kidney, but it works. And it's from 3D printed human tissue. Bottom right is liver cells. Now, let's take that ear and instead of just making it a cosmetic fix, let's also put an acoustic ear coil transmitter in that ear. And now you change that ear from not only just a cosmetic thing with 3D printed cartilage and potentially skin, but now a functional acoustic organ. How about insertion of progenitor cell lines? Could I take that same technology and take stem cells and put them in different tissues? The answer is yes. That could be the spinal cord, like in the upper middle. That could be in the pancreas in the upper right. That could be on a joint organ with cartilage, like in the lower left. And you can see some of the experiments already with putting a square of stem cell cartilage, which will be produced and produce more cartilage in the bone on the bottom right. But this isn't just fantasy. This is the first use of 3D printed tissue to make a trachea. This is an infant with tracheomalacia. They did a 3D printed organ of this trachea and inserted it into this infant to save the infant's life. Artificial heart. What about if I take stem cells and we start to grow tissue and use that in the lab and 3D print cells that can actually beat and actually produce electricity? Instead of having a total artificial heart like the upper left, what if I can actually produce your left wall and actually sew it into your heart if you've had an MI? What if I could actually replace the heart eventually with cells that are of the same haplotype so you don't have to worry about an organ donor? Well, that's coming too. This is on the International Space Station. That's Dr. Kate Rubens. She's sequencing DNA and growing cardiac cells on orbit on the International Space Station. Growing cardiac cells. That's a huge change in the fundamental aspects of medicine coming up in the next decade and a half. It doesn't stop there. Let's hit the bacterium. Let's talk about vaccines and pathogens. One of the biggest things that we're using the International Space Station for has been vaccine research. This is Dr. Cheryl Nickerson from Arizona State University working on vaccine research. It turns out crystals and proteins form differently in space. You can form crystals in space because of microgravity and the lack of gravity that you can't form on the ground, and you can fold proteins differently and microgravity that won't fold the same way due to gravity on the ground. What does that have anything to do with vaccines? Well, it creates new targets on the bacterium and creates new chemicals for the vaccine, such that, you know, we had a big salmonella outbreak recently in the United States. Salmonella research being done right now in the International Space Station for a vaccine for salmonella. But wait, it doesn't stop there. One of the biggest things that Dr. Nickerson's been working on and her groups have looked at is MRSA and found new targets on MRSA. Think about how many billions MRSA costs the U.S. healthcare system right now. How many patients do you have to readmit? How much antibiotics? How many days stay? How many lost work days? How many lost lives? How many billions does that add total to lost work days? What if we have a vaccine for MRSA? It's coming. Now, one of the things we worry about is, you know, radiation hits with spaceflight. And, you know, most of you followed probably Scott Kelly's mission, the one-year mission. What we worry about, there's two types of radiation in space. There's the coronal radiation, radiation from the sun, And for lack of a better word, let's think about that as like a shotgun with little pellets that come out. It's not high energy. We can block it. We have shields that we can put on. Anything that has a lot of hydrogen to it, we can block out a lot of those. And then there's what we call cosmic galactic radiation, or GCR, galactic cosmic radiation. And it's kind of like a high-powered rifle. It's a larger particle, like an iron particle, larger atoms and molecules. And it's coming out from outside of our galaxy, from probably some supernova from another distant galaxy, and it's zipping through space, and it goes through anything. It goes through the spacecraft, goes through the astronaut. We can't really, you know, protect them that much for that. Well, some of the things that we're working on is active radiation shielding, using essentially dipoles of positive and negative electricity and magnetics to shield the spacecraft. That may shield for radiation. That may have, some pretty interesting dynamics for radiation workers in the future. The other thing about cells and bacterium and things on orbit is that, you know, on the ground, you put a cell and a bacterium, you're going to look at strep. You have to put a, you know, on a slide and a little fluid and a cover slip, and it's two-dimensional. It's flat. So when you're looking at it, you're looking at it in a two-dimensional space. In space, this is one of the micrographs from space, it's three-dimensional. We don't have gravity. The stuff doesn't slide off the slide. Surface tension keeps it there, so you don't have to worry about turning the slide upside down and having a cover slip and things will run down. That allows the researchers to identify different things on the cell that they wouldn't have seen on a two-dimensional space. Technologies, even small technologies that we're working on right now, this is one that I worked on in the Arctic. Unfortunately, the Arctic, Devon Island, is an analog for Mars. I'm not really sure why Hawaii couldn't be an analog for Mars, but I always get to go to the Arctic. The C-pod is the upper left. That is just about the size of your iPhone. It's actually a little smaller now. And it does the EKG, pulse ox, temperature, the whole works. So think about that big pro pack you have hanging off when you take a patient down to x-ray, et cetera. I can get all of that, not only with the C-pod, but it also transmits it up into the heads-up display for the astronauts. So if there's an astronaut injured on Mars, when I get close to them, I can hit a button and I can see what their vitals are and what their temperature is and all of their vital signs. If you think about Google Glass, eventually you may be able to do that with a patient as well, where you're walking into the room and the patient's vital signs are suddenly in your glasses. You don't have to go looking for the chart or going out to the telemetry to see what happened to the patient. You can actually see it. Wearable technologies, obviously Apple, a lot of folks working on wearable technologies, as is NASA. You may be able to check somebody's blood sugar through the skin. That's one of the things that we're working on right now, is to be able to do different assessments of chemistries through the skin without poking somebody. And so using almost similar technology to you do with the waveforms for pulse ox, but at a much different level, to where eventually your patient may be able to wear a wristband that looks like a watch and be able to record and look at their blood glucose. This is one of the things that we're working on that might have a transition. The astronauts, when they get up into orbit, they're pretty busy. We have a lot of things for them to do, like working on, you know, cardiac cells and other things. But the psychiatrists want to be able to tell, how's the astronaut feeling? Is he happy, sad, et cetera? And of course, if you ask a fighter pilot, Navy fighter pilot, what are they going to say? Especially when the doctor's asking them, I'm great. Yeah, it doesn't matter what they are. One of the things that we found out when we flew folks on the International Space Station, we put a telephone on orbit. It's a satellite phone. I'm not going to give you the number. But we thought, this is fantastic. That means now, after they're done working, they can call home, they can talk to their families. This will alleviate all the stress of being on orbit. Little problem with that. Astronaut works all day, calls home. Oh, I thought you said you were going to call the roofer before you left. On the next time that you pass over Colorado, I expect you to call the roofer and tell him to work on this roof. And Johnny got a D in math. Talk to Johnny. I'm not the one who tutors him in math. You are. And so suddenly the problems from Earth were creeping up onto on orbit. This is a software program that we've been working on, changing the facial recognition software to identify the computer algorithms working with things like IBM Watson, et cetera, so we can identify if somebody's happy, sad, angry. Why would you want that? Well, it's nice to be able to tell if the astronaut, what's their mood, et cetera, on a snapshot. What if somebody were able to take that picture in a hotel lobby and tell if somebody was disturbed or not? Would that have prevented something like Las Vegas? I don't know. But that technology, that possibility, is on the horizon. Now, the only place that that's not going to work is the License Bureau, because everybody going to be angry and upset in the License Bureau line. So, bone research we're working on a lot. One of the things that we found, the astronauts lose bone on orbit, and then when they get the bone back. So let's take Scott Kelly, for instance. He loses bone about 1% to 2% per month, but we do a lot of exercise, resistive exercise. We use bisphosphonates and other things to try to keep that bone together. But what we noticed was when the bone comes back, although they lose it in the trabecular area, when it comes back in the cortical area. And so what was interesting about that is the density was the same, but the strength was not. So one of the things that we figured out, and eventually there was an article in the New England Journal of Medicine that showed this as well, is that even with bisphosphonates, your density might be great. That does not equate to strength necessarily. And so there were fractures in patients in the surgical neck of the femur who were on bisphosphonates. And there were several articles in the New England Journal of Medicine. Why are we seeing these fractures? These patients are on bisphosphonates. Chalk is dense. Chalk is not strong. There's a difference between density and the ligation that occurs in the bone in the center. And so cortical bone doesn't necessarily equate to strength. And so that's what we were seeing. So probably the third generation or fourth generation bisphosphonates will be looking at not only density, but can we prevent the bone from having its cancellous portions and its ligands from deteriorating. Some old Apollo technology, most of you may not realize that's also the same material that's used in space blankets to keep folks warm, trauma patients, runners, etc. Most of you have, this is Skylab, 1973, right? Skylab. Most of you have this in your home. Well, not the exact module, but piece of technology of Skylab in your home. Anybody know what it is? Well, you see, we had to figure out, the astronauts are going to be asleep on this space station. We wanted them to be awakened if there was a fire. So we invented this thing that would pick up ions of carbon called a smoke detector. So you all have those in your homes by law now. That came from Skylab. So, we always say, when there's spring forward or fall back, when we have changes of the clocks, that's when we always remind people to change the batteries in their smoke detector. Now you can tell your neighbor that you're changing the power source in your Skylab technology at home. And you're not lying. This is Scott Kelly for his one-year mission. Scott Kelly, we did a unique study, essentially placebo-controlled trial. Now, granted, at NASA, you got to remember, there's only so many astronauts that fly in space. So one's a case study, two's a series, three's a prospective randomized controlled trial. That's the kind of end we're working on. Scott, had us a twin brother, identical twin. And what a unique opportunity for us to be able to compare him with his identical twin. And to be able to see the changes in his chromosomes that occurred due to radiation, and the changes that occurred in his bone and his muscle due to microgravity, and the changes that occurred in his optic nerve due to the fluid shifts, and all the things that we see compared to his brother. And it was actually extremely enlightening. In fact, more so than anyone expected. The researchers, Harvard and elsewhere, were floored because there were different things that we expected with the chromosome that did not occur. And there were other things that occurred with the DNA that we did not expect. We expected due to radiation hits that his telomeres would be shorter and Scott's were longer. There were changes in how the cell repaired itself that we did not expect. This opened up a lot of knowledge in epigenomics and pleogenomics, proteomics, that really will change a lot for how we understand how the DNA works and how the cells repair themselves. You couple that with CRISPR technology, And suddenly that changes things a great deal for medicine. And it gave us greater insight for how the DNA repairs itself and where the DNA splices and how those things work. And that, in addition to CRISPR technology, will change a lot in medicine. Think about being able to get rid of Duchenne's muscular dystrophy. That's on the that's on the horizon and a decade from now. Probably within 20 years, Duchenne's muscular dystrophy may not exist. Or if it exists, we'll be able to correct it. That's huge. It also changes personalized medicine. It means that we can identify targets on a DNA. What if I gave you a medication that only works for you and your particular codon and your particular DNA? What if we are able to alter and change the medications for cancer instead of killing out all the normal cells just to get to the cancer cells? What if I'm able to just get the cancer cells and leave your normal cells intact? That's on the highway very soon as well, because we are able to identify specific protein markers and specific DNA codons that we weren't able to identify before. A few other technologies you may not realize have their assets and coming from space. Upper left is CIMT, carotid intimal medial thickness ultrasound. There's a program that looks at all the different shades of gray and your carotid artery and identifies which of that is the soft plaque and the intimal medial layer. The software for that program came from the space program looking at 240 different shades of gray for planetary science. The right is infrared heat, which is used for trigeminal nerve pain, also from the space program. The lower left one is one that I'm really kind of interested in. We worked with J.J. Hannigman and some of the folks from University of Cincinnati on an autonomous closed circuit vent. So imagine, when you have a patient sucking in oxygen on a ventilator, they use a portion of it, but then a portion of it's not used and it goes out. Well, what if you were able to recycle that, the part that wasn't used, and feed it back to the patient? That's a closed circuit. What if you were able to then concentrate the air coming from the air into oxygen, give it to the patient, anything not used, recirculate it? Suddenly, you don't need those big green bottles anymore, right? You're sucking oxygen out of the air, concentrating it, giving it to the patient. Anything they don't use, you're recirculating it back to the patient. Imagine what that'll do for a third world country that can't afford those huge big green tanks for oxygen. Ah, but now we changed it a little bit more. What if I add software to the vent that changes the vent settings based on the patient and based on the nitric acid and based on the CO2 and based on the O2 and the respiratory rate and the pressures? That's coming as well. So instead of a respiratory therapist walking around with a clipboard, changing the vent based on an order you wrote 4 hours ago, the vent will wean the patient. And the vent will send you a text. Dr. Juhas, Mrs. Johnson, she's doing better. I lowered her to an FiO2 of 40% and, SIMV of 12. Hugs and kisses, the vent. Bob's looking for that text coming, aren't you? That's not that far off. That technology, at least for the closed circuit concentrating, exists now. That's what I use on the space station now. I concentrate the O2, I put it into the cylinder. Anything the astronauts don't use, I recirculate, I put it back in. Virtual reality technology, we've been using this for well over a decade at NASA. The guys will practice the spacewalks long before they get into the neutral buoyancy lab, which is our big, huge pool where they practice the spacewalks. They do this multiple different times, and that same technology is now changing medical education. I still think, dissecting and cutting on a cadaver is the way to do medical education to get the haptics, but, in this generation where they grew up on video games, et cetera, augmenting that education with something like this is probably a good thing. This is our work site that we do all the time, but we are all the time discovering new things and different ways to do things like a spacewalk and et cetera. And all of those things that we discover, how to concentrate the oxygen so that we use less out on a spacewalk, eventually translates into medicine. This again is our SLS and our Orion. You can imagine all the technologies that I have to invent and that NASA has to work on for the Mars mission. I mean, we're going to have to grow our own food. We're going to have to recycle everything, every part of it. We're going to have to make the solar cells even more valuable and able to turn energy on Mars. All of those different things that we are going to invent will eventually come down to Earth, and many of them into medicine. So we trained. This is, again, at Devon Island in the Arctic. We trained on how to do medicine for exploration missions. A lot of those technologies will bleed into EMS. One of the things that we invented not too long ago, we worked with Homeland Security to invent a heartbeat detector, but there was a problem with it. The amplification, because we're so used to listening to noise and other things, from planets looking for signatures for different aspects and huge telescopes and all the things that we do, it was too potent. And we thought, what can we use this with? Because we can't put it in the spacesuit; it's just too loud. We would, in addition to picking up the electrical signal, it's just too noisy. And we figured out, this could probably hear a heartbeat through rock. And you know what? It does. And so we've used it twice on two earthquakes now to identify victims and find victims that are buried below the rubble. And we worked on that technology with Science and Technology Department of Homeland Security, and that was just recently deployed again to Mexico to help find people that are buried under the rubble, again coming from spaceflight. This is obviously where we're headed at some point. That's not Arizona, although it kind of looks like it. That's where we're going to go in the short term with the idea of getting here. And hopefully all of those technologies will eventually find their way into your practice in some form or fashion, but you just won't know that they came from the space program. Or you might after today.